solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
So a big part of transitioning as a leader, it's not just about your skill set. A lot of it is also about your style and how you do things and how you show up and how you communicate, how you come across to people. And those things are a little bit closer to our sense of identity and our sense of authentic leadership. So they're a little bit scarier to think about altering and even playing and experimenting with, because it's not about, I don't know, using a different tool. It's about being a different kind of person.
Welcome to the 47th Conversation and the Play to Potential podcast. This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. I'm an executive coach, and I work with leaders during high-stakes transitions, whether it's related to an organization or the leader's career. I feel that just like companies need to be coherent about the two questions, where to play and how to win in the context of their business strategy, we all need to be clear about our responses to the two questions, where to go and how to grow. I help leaders play to their unique potential by addressing those two questions, especially during key points of transition as they go through their journeys. In this podcast series, I talk to leaders from multiple domains, CEOs, sportsmen, artists, thought leaders, and people from several other backgrounds on three broad themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. Before I get on to the next guest of this podcast, I should mention that I'm really excited about the lineup of podcast guests in the coming weeks. In the pipeline, we have an interesting set of guests. Next up, we have Paddy Upton, mental conditioning coach of the Indian cricket team that won the ICC Cricket World Cup in 2011. Quite a timely topic, given what we saw at Wimbledon and in the finals between New Zealand and England. Then we have Alan Eagle, who's a co-author of the book Trillion Dollar Coach, an insight into the methods of Bill Campbell, who's coached the who's who of Silicon Valley. Then we have Professor Linda Grattan, a professor at London Business School and author of the book 100 Year Life, who has insights around how leaders could think about staying relevant in a world where they possibly have to work till their 70s and 80s. And then we have Tasha Urich, who's the author of the book Insight and one of the leading thinkers in the area of self-awareness. Stay tuned for all this and more coming your way in the next few weeks. Now let's get to the conversation at hand. I'm excited about this for a couple of reasons. One, I got to record this conversation at my alma mater, London Business School, where I spent 2 years for my MBA, so it was lovely being back on campus. And number two, this conversation is with somebody who I believe is one of the leading thinkers, if not the leading thinker, in the space of leadership transitions. My guest is none other than Professor Herminia Ibarra. Herminia is the Charles Handy Professor of Organizational Behavior at London Business School. Prior to joining LBS, she served in the faculty of INSEAD and Harvard Business School. She spent several years researching leadership, transitions, and career development. Thinkers 50 ranks her among the top management thinkers in the world. Her book, Working Identity, is the one I refer to the most when I meet people who are at crossroads. She's subsequently written the bestseller, Act Like a Leader, Think Like a Leader, published by Harvard Business Press. Without further ado, let's dive into the conversation with Herminia. Herminia, thank you so much for your time. Excited to have you on the Play to Potential podcast.
Very pleased to be here. Thank you.
And always nice to be back on the London Business School campus. So thanks for hosting me here. Herminia, I want to sort of talk about your work in the space of transitions and leadership and several other things that you've been working on over the years. But before I dive into some of those areas, I'm curious about why people do what they do. So talk to me a little bit about what's the why behind your interest in transitions over the years.
Right. So, I mean, who doesn't make transitions? You know, the saying is that everything we do our research on is autobiographical in some way. You can always, you know, you can always find the connections. But ultimately, I think for me, what got me into this is that I always, even when my research was very quantitative, I always talked to people as part of the research, at first just to get background or just to interpret the numbers. And later then talking to people was the actual main event. But when you talk to people, you get to know them and you get to learn what's on their minds. What's usually on their mind is themselves and where they're stuck and where they want to go or how they don't manage to go where they want to go. And so you get there very, very quickly. I had started my research by studying people's networks and how they affected their capacity to innovate. But networks are also a very powerful tool for their careers. And so very quickly, we get to the person's career, where they're trying to go. The other thing that got me there is that I've always been interested in those shifts and transitions in an organization. Originally, I was interested in how people moved up. But as I talked to people, I understood that many of them wanted to move out and into a completely different career and were finding themselves stuck. And that's really the work that led to working identity, which wasn't meant to study career change at all. It was meant to study progression. Mm-hmm. But that's not where people's heads were at. And so I pivoted.
Got it. And I want to start with a quote from one of your books from Richard Pascal that you talk about. Adults are more likely to act their way into a new way of thinking than think their way into a new way of acting. I found that profound in many ways, and in a way that quote captures a the lot of the essence of what you believe in. So talk to us about what's the crux of the insight here and what do people get wrong? Yeah. When they think about this.
So let me first bring it to a concrete example that most people can relate to.
Sure.
And then we can get to the science, because all the research shows that that's, we learn by doing. Really, the insight is we learn by doing. Mm-hmm. But let's say, for example, the classic, the person who won't delegate, the micromanager control freak. So they know in their head that the right answer is to delegate and empower people. So you know what the right answer is. So it's not a matter of finding the right answer and then just executing, just implementing your steps to a better delegator. You know what it is, but the minute it matters, you seize control and you micromanage. The fact of the matter is, the issue is that the real mindset behind that behavior, what your experience has taught you, what's made you successful, is being a control freak. You're convinced, you know that your work is better when you do it yourself. And so that's ultimately why you don't do or why you don't execute on the right answer. How do you fix that? You have to take some small steps that actually get you success or more success with delegating. And that's harder. So what I found in my research is if you actually get people, forget about the delegation, actually get them focused on what are some things outside your immediate area that are exciting that you want to work on. And as soon as they have something else more interesting that they want to do, that they really want to do in their gut, they delegate so easily because it's in their own interest. And then they realize, they see the positive, and then they do more of it, and you're on a virtuous cycle. But they have acted their way into a new way of thinking about delegation, as opposed to just it being a superficial in my head thing that keeps me from doing what we know the right answer is.
Got it. And in the context of transitions, Herminia, I found this quote quite interesting as well, because in the work I do, and when I see leaders and the way they approach the transitions, they often, back to your work in working identity, you talk about the distinction between the three-step process earlier, think, decide, and jump, to sort of the more prototyping way of transition. So could you talk about the application of this code in that context?
Yeah. So it's, you know, the implications of this are often pretty scary for people, because we don't want to jump until we know what we're jumping to. And in fact, we like certainty. I take step one, which leads me to step two and gets me to step three. But that doesn't work at all when you're trying to make a career change, particularly when you don't know what you're changing to. And I found in working identity that people are very good at knowing what they no longer want, but they're less good at articulating what they want to do instead. And so you can't do the classic plan and implement model of career change. You have to experiment and learn. So you have to take some steps. Maybe you learn more and you decide that's not quite it, but that leads you to talk to a different person. It's much more iterative, but it takes longer. It's more uncertain. You have less control. And so people recoil from that instinctively at first. Eventually, they find that that's the only way you can go about it.
And the other term you use, Herminia, is the term outsight as compared to insight as a key element that will unlock future possibilities.
Yeah.
And I guess there are different pieces that go into outside, but talk to us about one of the few pieces here.
So the think and implement method can also be introspective. So, for example, what kind of leader am I? What kind of leader would I like to be? How do I adapt? How do I grow in a better direction? And so those are all things that we're tempted to treat much more introspectively. But in fact, when we're making a transition, whether it's in your career or to a different way of leading, to something you haven't done before, to a situation you haven't faced, that kind of approach, more reflective, is not that helpful because it just brings you back to what you've always done and who you've always been. And so what I call outside is just a little way of saying, get out of your head and get fresh perspective by trying some new things, connecting to some new people, essentially get some new experiences, and then you can reflect on them, but don't just keep reflecting on the same old. Create some new material for you to learn from. And that's what outsight is. Do some new things and then reflect on it.
This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. This insight from Herminia reminds me of my conversation at this podcast with Nandan Nilekani, who spoke about his experience with entering politics after his Rajya Sabha stint. Just to set some context, Nandan had had a phenomenal run at Infosys and was its CEO when it was a $3 billion company. He then took on the UID project and led the Aadhaar initiative. Post that five-year term, he decided to run for elections, and here he speaks about his reflections from the experience.
When I spent that time in the government was that the potential of technology to transform India was not sufficiently internalized by the system because people didn't come from that background. People were not technological background. Very few people like me were in the system. So then I realized that I'm a big believer that technological transformation is the way to go because that's the only way you're going to fix a lot of India's endemic issues. And then I thought, many times I was not able to sell my ideas, saying you can do this, you can do that. So I was getting a bit frustrated with my inability to sell my ideas. So then I said, maybe I should be one of them. Maybe if I'm a politician, then
have a voice.
I'll be the decision-making guy. So, and then I have the legitimacy to say this is the way to do it. So that's what drove, it was an intellectual choice actually to get into politics. But my experience was not very happy. And in that sense, I think that was one transition where I step too far in some sense. It is way outside my comfort zone. So I, after the election campaign and after that, I realized that this was not where I want to be. That I didn't have the leverage. I didn't have competitive advantage in that area. I didn't think I would be very effective. So I realized that actually my effectiveness comes from being what I'm good at, which is a technology-led transformation agent, and use my talents and abilities to solve large, intractable problems and make that available to anybody who wants to use it. So that was my shift.
After losing the election, he went back to his core theme of technology-led transformation agent and reorganized his life. And as an aside, he's now back as a non-exec chair at Infosys. To use Herminia's language, contesting the election gave Nandan fresh material for him to reflect on what would give him energy and make choices based on the reflection. If you're in transition, it's worth reflecting on what are the adjacent possible opportunities for you to craft an experiment and see how it goes. The related corollary is that you probably need to have a clear stop-loss point at which you will stop the experiment and go back to your core. If you wish to listen to this conversation, please go to playtopotential.com and look for Nugget 11.08 from Nandan Nilekani. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Herminia.
And how do you think about the tightrope between diluting yourself and going too far versus staying to your core? How do people think about that? Because there's a risk of just
Right. Play to your strengths versus, you know, not adding value because you're in something that's not your strength. Right. So, you know, we have to first approach this with a little realism. So, you know, nobody's going to become a rocket scientist or concert pianist at mid-career. So, you know, we know that. The problem is, just because something is your strength doesn't mean that you love it and you want to do it forever. So people like to play to their strengths. They like to be competent and be adding value for it. But people also like novelty and challenge and learning. It's a human need. And those two can clash. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, sometimes people simply change because they can't stand it anymore. Mm. But they still have to kind of build a bridge because nobody's going to hire them or finance them for something they don't know how to do. Mm. And that's what the transition process is. Where are you going to build the bridge? What are you going to draw from? Where can you find some common ground? All of that can be quite complicated. And it's often maybe not even the answer you would have thought at the very beginning. You have to learn your way through it.
And back to mid-career, Herminia, that piece is of particular interest to me, partially because I'm...
Autobiographically?
Given I'm sort of going through that phase myself. But given your experience, how much do you see people going through this phase of experimentation and exploration and ending up with, quote-unquote, a job versus maybe a portfolio of things that eventually they gravitate to? What's your sense of how that's playing out?
Yeah, so that's a really great question. I teach mid-career students, our Sloan Fellows here at London Business School, and that's a real question for them. They're in their mid-40s by and large, and they're trying to make big changes. But one of the big questions is, do I go back to a full-time job or do I create my own, whether it, the entrepreneurial route or the portfolio route or what have you? And there isn't a straight answer to that. But one of the things that happens as we grow older and maybe wiser and more experienced and we get to know ourselves more is we have less tolerance for situations that are not what we want them to be. Mm-hmm. We have less tolerance for the BS, for the politics, for the constraint and lack of flexibility in doing things the way we need to do them. And so often that leads people the portfolio route. The other thing is our companies are not always very flexible either. They don't know how to take somebody who has a skill set that's abstract, but maybe it's been practiced in a different context. I mean, you know that from your old executive search days. Organizations can be very rigid in how they look at people. And so you have these mid-career people who are full of excitement about the things that they can do and contribute, and they keep bumping up against the wall of these companies who want to pigeonhole them. And oftentimes that also leads them to create their own. But that's also a scary proposition. Nobody starts out there.
True. Yeah. And the other question that leads to is back to the theory of the firm, right? When you work with a firm, there's a brand that's being built by the corporate headquarters who's investing in building the brand, and that gives you a platform to work with. But when you're on your own, there's that piece that you know, one needs to work on in a deliberate, considered way. How do you see that playing out? Or let me ask the question differently. What do people often underestimate when they go down the portfolio route?
Well, there's that. If I could just backtrack for a minute, what you've just described is one of the biggest reasons why many of the most successful people who go portfolio always start with their past employer as their first biggest client. Because they're leveraging that brand and relationships and so on. And that gives them a little runway while they build up some of the new relationships. And I think in all of these transitions, the trick is how do you build yourself some runway? Because there is no leaping into the unknown. And that's one way to do it. With regard to portfolio career, I think people struggle with a lot of different things. One is it can be a bit lonely. It can be a bit, you know, when we work in a company, there's always a little dead time here and there, the boring meeting, the this, the that. And, you know, that sort of kind of helps you just catch your breath and keep going. Whereas when you're working portfolio, you're kind of either full on or you're thinking, gosh, this leisure is really costing me a lot of money.
There's an opportunity cost.
It's always playing in your head, and you're always thinking, gosh, should I be networking? Should I be reading? You know, what's the useful thing I ought to be doing? And that's hard. And then, you know, this won't be a surprise to you, the identity issue can be big in the portfolio career because we're used to associating ourselves with the brand of the company, or I'm a lawyer, or I'm a Google employee, or, you know, whatever that is. It's, you know, it's, of course, it's more complicated than that. But when you meet somebody, that shorthand is enough for them to peg you. And when you're in a portfolio, it isn't. And even at a deeper level, what I have found is that people tend to be happier when they have a bigger chunk. They have one bigger chunk in their portfolio that's more identity defining, mm-hmm. either because it's closer to what they want to be doing, or there's a few other people they're working with, or, you know, a portfolio that's a little bit of this and a little bit of this and a little bit of this. It's harder because there's an anchor. There needs to be an anchor in there somewhere.
Got it.
Does that resonate for you?
No, it does. I think I'm reminded of the work by Adam Grant where he talks about sprinkling versus chunking. And he says too much of sprinkling can sort of lead to just dilution. But the way you frame it from an identity standpoint is an interesting insight, mm-hmm. that it's nice to have a core that you can anchor around. I think that makes sense.
This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. Herminia's point about having a core anchor is an interesting one. One of my earlier guests in the podcast was Rajat Gupta, ex-global CEO of McKinsey, who later moved to a portfolio approach post-McKinsey. When I asked him about some of the decisions he regrets, he recounts the decision to do a portfolio rather than taking on a core role as something that he thinks about a lot.
One choice I debate, I don't know whether it's right or wrong. I mean, and I won't say what they are, but I had opportunities that were in the area of making broader social impact, but they would have to be singular. I mean, they were full-time jobs, and they were very meaningful jobs, and I decided not to take them because I thought the portfolio approach of, you know, having a little bit in business, for example, I had founded a private equity firm. I only spent, you know, part of my time there. And then I was doing these other things that I've talked about, that a portfolio approach would be more sensible for me at that stage, which I was in around 60, you know. But I'm not sure. I mean, it could have been that I should have, much like as I did in McKinsey and had a singular job, although I did a few other things, but I could have taken the same approach and taken a position that was actually, you know, with a possibility of huge impact, primarily in the social field, mm-hmm. and still being able to do a few things. But
sure.
But I didn't do that.
Sure. The other view I find helpful when we have a portfolio of things going on is figuring out how we are building a balance sheet, whether it's capabilities, relationships, or reputation. And is there a coherence there, or is it diffused? I find that distinction helpful in figuring out if there needs to be a core that needs to be front and center and a few other initiatives around the core. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Herminia.
Moving to a different theme, Herminia, you talk about I encounter in the work I do with leaders who are often mid-career successful type A is mind space, to create the mind space for transitions. And I found a quote or an example that you refer to in the book where you talk about Sendhil Mullainathan and Eldar Shafir. And you talk about an example where they talk about an operating room in a hospital where they keep an empty room, and somehow that drives more productivity. And you relate that back to people creating that mind space. So back to the point around transitions, what have you observed about people trying to create that mind space? What are some of the watch outs for people here?
Yeah, no, that's good. It's really about bandwidth. And the more what we're trying to do is non-habitual, the more you also need not just clock time, but mental availability, the sense that you can kind of step back and reflect, and you're not going to jump into something just because it's come to you on a silver platter. And so, you know, it's in the workplace, it manifests itself by just being too busy and crammed with meetings. And so in leadership transition work, what we find is that people only leave such small slivers of time that then all they could do is fill it with a few minutes of answering emails because it's not big enough to do anything else. And so thinking about precisely chunking it a little bit more so that you can do more value-added things is important. In career transition, it's a little bit different. It is oftentimes you have to let the process go for a while before you actually start to get the ahas of what you're trying to do and what you're really running away from and what you would really like instead. It's not all that obvious at first. And so it takes going through the process. But what happens is people get kind of nervous once it's been a few months or, you know, gosh, you know, what's it going to look like on my CV? And I'm meeting the same people and they're saying, oh, are you still on that sabbatical? Or, you know, and it feels quite not right. And so they can sabotage themselves because it feels like they're being idle when in fact, maybe what they're doing is just recouping, gathering forces, incubating ideas. They haven't found the right thing yet, but that time can be quite necessary, even if it's uncomfortable to go through it.
Mm-hmm. And in your research, Herminia, back to the quantitative side of things, not to say there's one answer, but clearly it's heavily contextual. But do you see a sort of a median or how do you see the spectrum of the time it takes for senior leaders, let's say successful leaders in the mid-40s, to move from, let's say, context A to context B? Is it 6 months, 12 months? Do you have a...
3 years. It's still 3 years. Mm-hmm. It's. I mean, I ask people all the time, you know, we have people here who are in a program that's a one-year program, and they're hoping that will do the trick, and it never does. And it's very frustrating because, and honestly, you know, part of it is where does it start? When does the time frame actually start? Because there's also the bit of getting yourself to the point where you can start walking. And so it's often a longer chunk than you think. But it's if you think about extricating yourself, getting yourself to the point where you're actively looking for something else, mm-hmm. and then the looking, and then the finding the just exactly the right. And if you've taken time off in between and you're taking on back to school in between, it can easily be 3 years.
True.
And it's because people are not going to hire you unless you have the experience. It's because you don't have the network into that yet. You don't even have the language. You're still sorting it out for yourself. Experiment and learn takes a little bit longer. And that's the hard part for people, but that's often why they also go portfolio. They start consulting on some of the old stuff just to make sure some money's coming in because you've got to continue life.
True. And talking about networks, Herminia, you talk about leaders developing three different types of networks, operational, personal, and strategic. And you also use the term connective advantage, which is about how these networks come together. Could you talk about the crux of the insight here?
Sure. I mean, we do, past a certain point in our careers, we do everything through relationships. That's how we get things done. That's how we find out what's going on. That's how we get advice, perspective, everything. And most people who are doing well have very good operational networks that just help them get the day-to-day work done more smoothly. Maybe, you know, they'll get something done faster for them or they'll get the information they need sooner. But, you know, it is really kind of what's in the critical path of my routine day-to-day work. That's the operational network. The personal network is the part that is, you know, the people you've worked with who've become friends and you've stayed in touch with, and there's more emotional quality to it, or maybe some old mentors, and there's often common interests. They're longer term relationships, and most of us have those too. And then the hard part, the tricky part, is the strategic network, which has to do, you know, if the operational is about you today, the personal often is about your past. The strategic's about your future, and it's about how do you connect the dots between some of your interests and relationships that are maybe external to your company, some of the internal relationships, help connect people, help bridge across different areas, help bring new ideas in, help export new ideas. It's really where you're adding unique value in the context of your work, but in the more strategic aspects of it.
Mm-hmm. And maybe just to bring that aspect to life, Herminia, because a lot of the one and two almost come by default, because, you know,
they happen more organically. The strategic, you have to work at it.
Deliberate. So are there a couple of examples you could share of people who've been thoughtful about cultivating these networks,
well,
given the journey?
You know, one example that struck my eye a couple of years ago, so the one that's first coming to my mind, is when Beth Comstock was still at GE as chief marketing officer. She felt that she was oftentimes much more connected to the outside world than most people in operational jobs at GE, which tended to be more internally focused. And so she felt, even though it wasn't part of the job description, that part of what she could do is bring the outside in for those people. And the example that I loved is she was at a book talk in Silicon Valley for the launch of The Lean Startup by Eric Ries about fast prototyping, which originally was a book written for startups. How do you go to scale quickly, minimum viable prototype? But she just thought, you know, aha, we're taking too long in our product development. Our turbines are taking too long to develop. And I bet we could use some of these ideas in a more classic manufacturing context. Let me make the connections. And she did. And a big part of GE Aviation then got trained on these methods to kind of make the process more agile. So that for me is a great example of how you can be strategic. You've got access to something others don't. And so you see the idea here and the need there, and you bring them together.
Got it. And in the context of networks, you also talk about the distinction between a hub and a bridge in the way the leaders can think about. Would this be an example of how she was?
It's related. She was there. She was definitely acting as a bridge. And the way I talk about hub and bridge is, I think it's important for all of us as we're making a transition to think about how we're doing our day job. Mm-hmm. And whether the way we're doing it opens up opportunities to see more and different, or actually keeps us encapsulated. And so for me, hub and bridge are ways of doing your work. And some people do their work as a hub in which they're the center of the action. Everything kind of goes through them, and they're involved in everything critical in their team or their business unit or their project. And other people do their work as a leader more as a bridge, meaning they see their main role as connecting the outside and the inside and making sure that the team or the unit is getting political support, money, you know, budget, headcount, talent, information, that the relevant stuff is coming in, that the relevant stuff is coming out, but really the one who can protect from the environment, who can bring the good elements in, who can sell their ideas upwards. So they're different ways of operating, and they produce different networks.
Got it. Moving to a different theme, Herminia, you talk about identity work and identity play. And I love the term identity play. And you talk about how play often frees you from the authenticity trap. Again, I found that distinctively insightful in the context of how people transition. So if you could elaborate on that.
Right. So a big part of transitioning as a leader, it's not just about your skill set. A lot of it is also about your style and how you do things and how you show up and how you communicate, how you come across to people. And those things are a little bit closer to our sense of identity and our sense of authentic leadership. So they're a little bit scarier to think about altering and even playing and experimenting with, because it's not about, I don't know, using a different tool. It's about being a different kind of person. And so, for example, you know, people who try to learn how to communicate more personally with a personal story with a bit more emotion, or people who try to move towards more of a coaching leadership style and they feel like they're not doing anything at all because they're not driving the conversation or the results. And so it's a trigger. It's a trigger. It's, this is not authentic. This isn't me. And when you feel this isn't me, you don't do it. It's really aversive to feel like a fake. And so you don't, you know, you'd rather be wrong and not be successful and be yourself than actually be yourself. I mean, get it right, but it doesn't feel like it's who you are. And so that's a real dilemma for a lot of people. And I saw it a lot in my research, you know, people who need to network up to stakeholders who are more senior in their organization. For a lot of people, that feels selling out, not meritocratic, political, using people, just wrong. And so what do you do? Because you're stuck between your sense of who you are and your sense of what it takes to succeed, and you're stuck. And so my point here is that it doesn't, the fake it till you make it doesn't work. It only works if that's what you aspire to be. But in a lot of cases, you don't aspire to be that. You kind of think it's a little shaky. And so all you can do is say, you know what? Being authentic doesn't have to condemn me to being as I always have been. Obviously, what I'm doing is not working. I'm going to give myself license to deviate, to play around a little bit with possibilities. And then I'll see, I'll gauge it, I'll evaluate it. If it's really not right for me, I don't have to stick to it. I'm not committing to being that person, but I'm at least committing to trying some things totally outside my comfort zone and see, based on my own experience, if I can tweak it, if I can make it my own, but I'm going to at least try something else.
And maybe just an example to bring this to life, Herminia, somebody, a senior leader who embarked on the journey.
So I was just with a whole bunch of senior people in a big oil and gas company, and they're all trying to figure out how do they lead in a more personal way, and how can they communicate in a way that makes their message more personal, more compelling to people. Actually, we were just having the same conversation with a group of executives from the car maker Renault here on campus. And that's for people who have been always very data driven and by the numbers. That feels almost hokey, manipulative, trying to follow a recipe. And it's just really hard to get themselves to do. It doesn't feel natural, but they understand that when it's done well and from the heart, it touches people. You know, we were watching a video of Satya Nadella talking about his own life and what it taught him, and everybody universally admires it when it's real and genuine, but they just don't know how to do it themselves. They have to work at it to get to that point for themselves. And that working at it period in between feels awkward. So that where the identity play and the identity work come in is, if you feel like you're having to work at it, that means it's more impression management. Whereas if you feel like you're kind of playing at different possibilities for who you might become, you give yourself a little bit more permission, because you're going to try different things. It's not necessarily going to be all the same. You can deviate and see what happens.
Got it. And back to mid-career transition, Herminia, I'm curious about how people reinvent themselves. And you particularly talk about a couple of dimensions, commitment and exploration. And you talk about the different, back to my consulting roots, the 2x2 appealed to me. But I was particularly curious about the one quadrant for closure that you talk about, which is a risk. A lot of people don't acknowledge that there's a suboptimality to it. So talk to us about how you think about it.
So that was part of the playful thing. I said there's two bit when you're kind of when you're making a transition, people think you go from A to B, but you don't. You go from A to this transition thing, which we call liminality in our technical jargon, to be. Mm-hmm. So in between, you're neither here nor there, and it's horrible because you lose your identity anchors. And so in that space, it behooves you to be a little bit more playful because you're neither here nor there. So that means you don't have to be consistent, and you can try and you can talk to people about jobs you'd never consider, or you can do things that are pretty much out of character, but you know you're trying to learn something. And that can be very freeing because we don't often give ourselves permission to deviate.
There are no corporate guidelines.
No. And so the two principles are, as you said, divergent exploration and delayed commitment. Divergent explorations is, what I mean by that is, whenever I teach people who are in transitions, one of the first things I do is I say, write a list of your possible selves. They don't have to be feasible. They don't have to be public. They don't have to be something you're committing to do. But just let your imagination run wild. What's the set of possibilities? Do a kind of brainstorming with yourself. Don't be embarrassed to write. Even if it's ridiculous, put it in there. And it's really interesting what people come up with. It's quite, in fact, we are very multiple and often quite divergent. Doesn't mean you're going to do all of those things, and certainly not at the same time. But when you get permission to be divergent, there's a lot there. And in fact, one of the things that is hard for people in transition is they feel that they must not be ready because they're considering such a different array of options. And they feel that somehow that's wrong, that they are equally passionate and excited about two things that seem mutually exclusive, like getting promoted at my current firm and then starting up a business on something completely different. And one day you're excited about this and the other day you're excited about that and you think you're out of your mind. But in fact, what we're doing is trying to explore and compare and contrast, and how do I feel here and how did I feel there? And so when you give yourself, and that's why it takes time, that's why the time factor plays in, to explore more divergently and say, this is actually natural and it gives me more information so that then I can make the right choice. You make better decisions and you're less likely to do the other thing, the foreclosure, which is take the first thing that comes your way because it's been 6 months and I can't tell people anymore that I'm still, you know, out of work. So the delayed commitment comes from understanding that it's going to take time and you're not going to go for the first thing that comes up or the second thing until you really had a chance to test. Because once you jump, you're going to be stuck there at least another 2 years. And so why not take a little longer at the beginning in order to make a more robust choice?
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. I think there's something to be said about efficiency and effectiveness when it comes to transitions. The default tendency is to look at efficiency metrics while dealing with a transition. The default metric that people gravitate towards is elapsed time to find the next opportunity. That's also possibly amplified by the soft pressure that they perceive from colleagues, friends, and family. I find that people lose a lot more sleep over how much time has elapsed and a lot less sleep over how much they've explored and tried and how much they've reflected about themselves in that period. And this paradox is fascinating to observe. While the period of limbo or liminality, as Hermenia frames it, is unnerving, grappling with it, having a discipline around exploration, being at it for a period of time, reflecting on the experiences and then launching onto the next trajectory can be immensely effective and fulfilling and save a lot of churn and heartburn over the medium to long term. In my experience, I find that foreclosure as one of the most critical, yes, least talked about elements when senior leaders transition from one context to another. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Hermenia. And picking on that piece about identity vacuum, or let's say the liminality phase where your identity is between the two states, what are some of the, tips or suggestions you have for people to sleep well at night during that phase?
I think the biggest thing is finding some kindred spirits who are going through that too, so that you don't think it's just you who are going crazy. So that's one. And then the other thing is, I have found this consistently. So it's been now I don't know, is it 20 years since Working Identity? It's been, the book's been out a bit, but it holds, it really does hold up, because I guess everybody I meet tells me their career transition stories. You need the kindred spirits, because that period betwixt and between is very hard on your life partner. Your life partner freaks out. Right. You know, sometimes it's the money, like the livelihood of the family, if you've been the breadwinner. Sometimes it's just the sanity. Sometimes they're going through it too. But it's just, it's really, you know, for them, because they're not, if they're not in it, they're thinking, plan and implement, just pick something and execute. What is all of this wishy-washy? And they don't understand that it's, you're going through a process that is more intuitive and more discovery based. And if you try to force it, you'll make a dumb mistake. So I think kindred spirits, having tolerance for your spouse who's just trying to keep you from doing something stupid, but just doesn't, you don't really understand what this is like until you go through that process yourself.
And I was talking to Stuart Friedman of Wharton, who talks about work life. And he talks about managing expectations of the stakeholders, including your life partner, as a key element. So in your experience, is it a one-on-one conversation between the person and the spouse? Or do you think there are other creative things that people do to bring them in?
I think you communicate a lot. But I also think that, you know, couples are delicate things. And I think that this transition process makes some couples stronger, and it brings out the worst in others, and that's because, you know, kind of the roles we play in personal life and in career, they kind of come together a lot, and you start undoing something, and it's hard for the other bits to hold up, because you, in a certain way, by changing, you might not be holding up your end of a bargain that was negotiated either explicitly or not. You know, and I've had people say, my spouse feels like this was not the deal that he signed up for, or what she signed up for. And the thing is, there is no permanent deal that's going to take you through any relationship. It's a constant conversation.
Got it. Just taking a particular let's say a cohort of people that I encounter, Herminia, advisors, bankers, lawyers, consultants, private equity professionals. I see a lot of them in their 40s, early 40s, mid 40s, possibly have made money for their lifetime, if you will, in a lot of these situations. Early entrepreneurs, I'll throw them in. And for a lot of them, it's about, if I had all the money, what would I do with my time? And they grapple with that question. How do I really, you know, plan to live my next, and back to Linda Grattan, how do I live my next 55 years? What are some of the, while some of the universal principles that you talk about here apply in this cohort as well, but maybe narrowing on this particular segment, is there something unique or specific you observe with this cohort?
Well, these are people who have been very, very driven in careers that are very, very greedy, that take all. And so, you know, for a lot of us, we do have other anchors for identity and maybe things that we do outside the main day job. The more that main day job is a kind of like a monolithic thing that takes all, the harder it is to extricate yourself. And then, you know, you start to see that it's not just the money, it's that that is your identity. And it is really scary to move beyond that. Now, what's universal is that for everybody, you don't move away from something good to something undefined. You just don't. So you have two possibilities, either that something is not good, and in fact, it's destroying you, and you know somewhere in your gut, even if you don't, can't articulate it, that you have to get out or it's going to kill you. You know, and sometimes those are the people who either have a burnout or actually take a long sabbatical and realize they can't go back to it, or your feet start walking and then later you catch up to the fact that you had to leave because it was going to kill you. So that's one option. The other option is, you know, that dissatisfaction starts to simmer and you start looking around outside. And this is the working identity story. A lot of people start to build up other things that reward them professionally, externally, through boards, through consulting, through startups, through investments, through teaching, you know. And as that thing kind of grows and becomes more interesting and becomes more identity defining, it gets easier to eliminate to move away from the first. But as I said, that process is harder in the very time greedy careers, and oftentimes with companies that are so identity defining because they're blue chip. You know, it's like, how could you leave Goldman Sachs, or how could you leave this partnership? We count on you. You're the only one that can do this. And this is where we start getting into the whole adult development sphere, where I think the work of Bob Keegan and Lisa Leahy has been incredibly important to understand how do we make a transition from making decisions that are based on others' expectations of us, what you need to do as a good husband, as a good organizational member, as a loyal partner in this firm, to what is it that I need to do for myself while still fulfilling obligations to others, but it's going to be me who drives that self-authoring aspect. And that's a big psychological shift. And it's hard to make it on your own, which is why networks are such an important part of making the shift. As soon as you see other people doing it, people who have come ahead, who have done well, who are in situations that you can admire, then it gets easier because you can see it in flesh and blood in front of you.
Got it. Just wrapping up, a couple of questions, Hermania. One is, what shifted, what stayed the same? If you look at, let's say, the kind of things that come up to your attention today versus, let's say, maybe 20 years back when you wrote Working Identity, in what ways are the kind of issues different today than they were earlier?
I think we're making more of those transitions. We're staying less time with our employers, even less than then, so it happens more often. I think we're getting more worried about being irrelevant at mid-career because of the just kind of the technology aspect being so present across so many different domains and industries. So we worry about that. On the other hand, there's just so many more people creating their own and doing freelance and portfolio that it's easy to find all kinds of examples of people doing that. There's lots of educational institutions that cater to that, many more mid-career programs, many more programs that help people become coaches, become consultants, you know, kind of make a shift, take the expertise they had and use it in a different kind of capacity while at the same time making them part of a network of people who are also going through that transition. So those things help out a lot. So we see a lot more of it. It's much more acceptable socially to say I'm taking some time out or I'm moving into something else relative to 20 years ago. But I think we're in a world in which pre-existing jobs in large established organizations are really hard to get at mid-career. And so that's another thing that's driving people towards creating their own.
Got it. Lovely, Hermania. This podcast is titled Play to Potential. This is about people discovering and playing to their unique potential. Any headline thoughts and summary for people to play to their unique potential?
Try some new things and see what happens.
Lovely. Pleasure talking to you, Hermania. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Three pieces struck me in this conversation. First is the point that Hermania makes around avoiding the risk of foreclosure when we are in transition. I think there are a couple of related thoughts here. One, there is enough research that has been done around what matters in the end when all is said and done. And the research clearly shows that over the long run, we regret our omissions
much more than our commissions. So in that context, it's worth reflecting on whether you've explored and reflected enough before you take a plunge and converge into something. And second, when we are in transition, there's an availability bias at play, which basically suggests that you overweight what you see, but you don't see the bigger picture. It is a bit like reading about an airplane crash and concluding that flying is dangerous, while if you did the statistical analysis, it might turn out that flying is much safer than a lot of other things we do. When I work with leaders in transition, one of the pieces I watch out for is whether the leader is converging and closing too soon without going broad enough. I tell them upfront that my metric is not time to find the next role. It is to ensure that you've tried enough, reflected enough, and hopefully got to a decision that's consistent with your overall picture. When you're in transition, I can imagine that it can be anxious, and a bird in hand could feel better than five in the bush. The second insight that struck me in this conversation was the notion of carrying the people around you, with you in the transition journey. The point Herminia makes about being in close touch with the spouse is quite a profound one. What people don't realize is that by default, most people around you, including your spouse, expect you to quickly get to an answer in a short period. The notion of liminality and exploring possibilities and multiple selves is quite fuzzy and unsettling for the rest, even if they get it. So the onus is on the person going through the transition to be in close touch with the family members and give them comfort around what they're doing and align them on the thinking process. And like Herminia says, transitions are a great opportunity to have authentic conversations with the people around you on what matters, what trade-offs you're willing to make, and what the stop-loss point should be for the experimentation phase. It's a great trigger to have the conversation with your family so that you get the support when you're going through the phase of identity vacuum during the liminal phase. When I reflect on my transition from Egon Zehnder to transition advisory and podcasting, I would strongly credit the role of my wife, who played an integral role in being my sounding board and by reiterating the why behind the choices I'd made on some of the bad days I face. The last point from the podcast I wanted to highlight was the point around catch-22 that a lot of professionals get into, especially when they are in intense professions like law, consulting, banking, private equity, VC investing, and so on. One is that they have limited mind space to process the increasing disconnect between the profession and the life context, hence the catch-22. But the nuance that Herminia provides in this context is interesting. She speaks about these professions being identity-consuming. The people in these professions haven't had time to do much else and identify too much of themselves with the profession, and that makes it harder for them to even evaluate a possibility in a different direction. So it's helpful to watch out if we are falling in that bucket. Thank you for listening. If you find the content in this podcast of value, please rate the show and write a review on iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you consume the content. And to access tailored, bite-sized modules from our various conversations, you could visit the curated playlist section at playtopotential.com. The next podcast conversation, as I said, is with Paddy Upton, the mental conditioning coach of the Indian cricket team that won the World Cup in 2011.
About improving his game of cricket, I never saw anyone prepare better and more intentionally than Sachin Tendulkar, literally day in, day out, week in and week out. And, you know, I was with him from his 18th to 21st year of international cricket, and he was still probably the most diligent practicer of the lot. But at the same time, because of the heights of fame that he had received, in order to keep himself grounded, he would, you know, it's very easy to get caught up in the heights of fame and get blinded by the limelight. Because what happens to these athletes, and I see it also with very successful and higher profile businessmen, is people around them treat them, give them special treatments, treat them as VIPs, very important people, or VVIPs. And they start to think, because they're treated as special people, they start to think that they are special people. But the reality is, as human beings, we are all just human beings. And the talents we have, we all have different talents, but that's separate to who we are as a person. And Sachin was just someone who understood that I have a special talent to hit a cricket ball, but that doesn't mean I'm a special person. It means I'm a talented cricketer who needs to also work on being a good person.
Given you're listening to this podcast from Herminia Ibarra, you might specifically find the themes reinventing yourself and navigational principles relevant. You might want to go to the curated playlist section at playtopotential.com. The playlist Reinventing Yourself is about leaders who were at inflection points, who were courageous to try different things and move to a different context. This includes Amish Tripathi, who speaks about how he moved from a career in financial services to writing, Rupa Kudva, who spoke about moving from Crisil to Omidyar Network, Papa CJ, who spoke about moving from management consulting to stand-up, Nanda Nilakeni, moving from Infosys to the UID project to trying out politics, Atul Kasbekar, who spoke about how he moved from being a photographer to a producer, Devdutt Patnaik, who spoke about moving from healthcare to mythology, and so on. Hopefully, the diversity of perspectives will provoke your thinking around how to navigate the transition. The other playlist that might interest you is Navigational Principles, which gives you a flavor of the frameworks that various people used to deal with these inflection points. In a world with more divergent pathways than before, the quality of the steering wheel is possibly as important, if not more important, than the quality of engine that we have in our car. This playlist gives you some thought starters which will help you build a more robust steering wheel for yourself. You can access these playlists in the curated playlist section at playtopotential.com. And finally, to know more about the leadership and transition advisory work I do, please visit the About section at playtopotential.com. I look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations at the Play to Potential podcast. Bye now.